Blog Talk Radio.
It's Monday night, and that means it's the latest episode of Graphic Policy Radio coming to you live. This is the show that mixes comics, geekdom, and politics, and is perfect for folks who wonder if S.H.I.E.L.D. suffers from sequestration. I'm your host, Brett, and tonight we have a guest joining us, Emma Hubois, who hopefully I haven't butchered her last name. Emma is a queer blogger for hire out of Vancouver, British Columbia, which I've heard wonderful things about, and she was most recently attached to Girls Read Comics. But before we get to her, joining me is always the brilliant Alana. How are you doing?
Hi, great to be here this week and back in session.
So I think Emma called in, so let's bring her on. Emma?
Okay, yeah, I'm here.
Hey,
how are you doing?
Excellent, and you got it right. I wasn't
Welcome
sure how
to the
my
show.
Over email would work out. But yeah, no, it's great to be here. How are you guys doing
Fantastic.
Tonight?
I'm
good.
I've heard more. I was going to say, how is Vancouver? Because I've heard amazing things about there. I've never been up there yet.
Well, I'm sure a lot of what you hear about Seattle would be, you know, applicable enough. It rains here a lot, but when it doesn't, it's really nice. I mean, I'm originally from the prairies further out east, so there's no winter here, right? No matter what people born here might try to tell you. But we maybe get 2 days of snow a year. It never gets below minus 10 Celsius. Celsius, I should say. Minus 10 Fahrenheit is a whole other issue.
Yeah,
it doesn't get cold. It is a beautiful day today outside. I'm not sure exactly what the weather is, but somewhere in the high 20s, I would imagine.
Nice.
We're struggling back here in the eastern seaboard of the mid-Atlantic of the United States. I pretty much have to continually down fluids, so I don't pass the heck out. It's been a good weather for staying in your apartment and catching up on comics, so long as you have air conditioning. It's pretty much the gist of my past few days.
Go ahead.
So we've known you sort of through the internet so far, and I personally have always been really impressed by your commentary and perspective that you offered on, you know, my great love, which is superhero comics. And when Brett and I talked about expanding to have different guest hosts join us, you were one of the first folks who came to mind for me, and I'm really glad you said yes and are joining us today. And I guess I just wanted to get a quick version from you for folks who aren't familiar with you. How did you get into comic books?
I taught myself to read from a Ninja Turtles comic book at age 6. No, it's probably younger than 6. But I mean, comics have kind of always been a thing for me. The opportunity to come on the show actually came in a great time for me. Because I'm looking to get back into comics journalism and a more public venue for talking about them. I've kind of been in and out of it for years. I sort of helped run a defunct comic website years ago that kind of culminated for me in going to the San Diego Comic Convention and getting to, you know, interview some great people. And so that was kind of a high moment. But comics, you know, it's a real... When you're as passionate about comics and representation and things like that, they can be kind of an up and down and a roller coaster. And 2011 was really kind of when I last wrote the most for, you know, Girls Read Comics. And that was a great experience, but it just kind of hit at a really stressful point for me in my life, and I had to take a back seat and resign from there after a little bit. But it was a great experience. And now that I'm more comfortably able to pursue this long term, and that there's so many great things to talk about now, you know, now that we're kind of sort of over the hump of the new 52, and a lot of the fallout from that, and some of the things that have happened at Marvel, it's a really great time to be coming back around to comics and being able to invest long term. I think, especially now that digital comics have taken hold. So well, and it's so easy to get your comics every week as long as you have an internet connection.
That's true. That's true. Do you get most of your stuff digitally these days?
Right now, I would say I do, yeah. I mean, it's interesting to me that, and maybe there's a solution for this that I don't know about yet, but manga is the large quantity of what I would buy physically these days. Because, I mean, through the Comixology app, you've got your DC, you've got Marvel, you've got most of the minor publishers. I haven't, I just picked up a couple Image Comics, but I haven't checked out their new service that they just launched through the website, the DRM free solution that they've been touting, because it was just right there in Comixology, so I just pushed the button. But yeah, I would say most of what I buy, unless it's older stuff or manga, I go to the comic store to buy T-shirts and statues.
Yeah, yeah.
Today, what are you generally reading?
Well, like I said, it's only been over the last month or so that I've really gotten serious about reading comics again. But let me see, Fearless Defenders. I'm still catching up on Captain Marvel, which is pretty good and getting stronger with every issue that I read. So probably once I get up to the current stuff, I'll say it's amazing. FF, of course, which I'll be talking about later. Hawk Guy. I'm not calling it Hawk. What is his actual name?
Hawkeye.
I just call him Hawkeye now. Hawkeye, right?
Everyone knows.
God, that's the thing. Like,
yeah,
that's stupid.
Yeah.
I mean, the stupid fan, well, not fan name, it's in the comic, but that nickname has just taken over for me, so I don't even know what to call him anymore. I just call him Hawkeye, which is probably exactly what they intend. I did recently read through Defenders, so I guess I had two flavors of Defenders going. Bondad, of course, as everybody should be. The Wake. Picked up both issues of that. Batman 66, of course. So I think mostly the obvious stuff. Heavy on the Marvel, as you can tell. Oh, and the Adventure Time stuff.
Oh, that's great. At least I should speak for myself. I'm a very big fan of the series, although I'm a little bit behind in the comics right now.
I've only actually read Marceline the Scream Queens and Fiona and Cake. I haven't actually read any of the issues of the main title yet.
But you're a fan of the show, too? TV show? Oh, that's right. I've heard stuff about it. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
That show's incredible. We've been really lucky to have some of the comic writers from the series on the podcast so far, and hope to continue with that. We one of the things that I'm trying to be better about through the show is to not just cover, you know, superhero comics. And Brett and I both come from that perspective, but the independent publishers are so much better about getting us review copies, and we really want to support the diversity of the medium. We're like definitely trying to make a point of including more of that work, but one of the things that both Brett and I just do not know is manga, to be honest. So if you have a suggestion list of comics that an audience, let's just say like an audience of people who are interested in social justice and in politics and in looking at the world through a sort of social justice lens, might be interested in reading manga-wise. I'd love to hear your suggestions.
Well, that is a little bit difficult because kind of one of the funny things about manga is that it's kind of very accessible to a white Western perspective because of how, I mean, I don't necessarily want to say completely racially homogenous, but it's very easy for Western viewer, a reader or viewer, to be, they're reading Sailor Moon and assume because she has blonde hair and blue eyes that she's interpreted to be, that she's white, right? Because the way, you know, a Japanese artist would cartoon a white person is far different than how a white American would, right? I can't remember what the name of the artist is now, but the guy who drew Pluto, you can really tell the way that, and of course, this varies by artist, but one of the kind of common things that when Japanese artists in manga, when they draw, you know, a white German guy or an American or something, is they have, you know, wider noses and exaggerated features like that. So sometimes it can be kind of difficult, or to me it's a little bit dissonant reading manga in that sense because you're, you know, overwhelmingly reading about Japanese characters and Japanese people and their dominant society. When on the flip side, to me as a white reader, it's really interesting because if you're reading in a West, you know, Asian characters in a Western comic, they're part of a, you know, a minority as part of, you know, population breakdown goes, right? So if you were reading a couple of years ago, Zombie, right, that series that had a Korean male lead, it'd be very different, you know, reading an American comic based in the States like that than you would, say, reading Sailor Moon, where the dynamics are totally different because all those characters are part of, you know, the dominant social group. Read Sailor Moon is what I'm telling you, one way or another.
Yeah, I've been meaning to do that for a very long time, actually. I've read such interesting things about the shows, like, not the show, but about the series in dealing with gender and all this other, like, really beyond the credit anyone would think to offer it, if just based on, you know, based on first glance. Where would be the place to begin on the series if you're someone who's not really familiar with it and is just sort of super impressed that the show manages that the series of queer characters? Like, that in and of itself to me is like, wow, that's awesome. So if that's all I know, like, really, where do I want to begin?
Well, you have two options. You can start reading through the comics, the manga, or the animated series. Either way is fine. I would say make sure that you're watching the actual, like, the I'm not sure if the whole entire animated series has ever been released in its uncut form in the States, because they chopped a lot out for various reasons when it first came over on TV, to the point where they had to add these little, you know, Sailor Moon says segments at the end of the episodes because so much material was gone. And the original dub, so much of the actual dialogue was completely off base from what was in the series. So if you're going to watch the cartoon, you have to make sure that you're watching the version that that ADV put out in, I'm going to say probably 2004, 2003, would be a good starting point that way. If you want to start it on the comics, which go in a completely different direction than the animated series, well, sort of. They're actually kind of hyper-compressed in terms of how quickly events progress. But if you're going to read the comics, you can kind of start with Sailor V, actually. Which is Sailor Venus's superhero alter ego, because that kind of, it's sort of, from what I understand, is that they were both running in digests, right? Because a lot of manga, most manga series that I'm aware of, mainstream ones, are published as part of, like, a giant anthology, like Shonen Jump and Shoujo Beat and stuff like that. So it would be like if DC just put out 5 monthly titles and you got, well, I guess, like, they did way back in the day, right, where you'd have Action Comics and it wasn't just Superman. You'd have the Atom and a bunch of other guys with backup stories too.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like that. And I think towards the end of Sailor V, what would be considered the second volume in terms of how you pick it up now, is where Sailor Moon starts up. Because basically Sailor V has a preamble and her own backstory introduced, and then everything else kicking out with Sailor Moon starts out in the first volume of Sailor Moon.
So for those of our listeners who are completely confused and surprised that we're talking about Sailor Moon and, like, how it's an important comic for, do you want to give some sort of background for people who, like, don't understand the significance of the series and why it's so respected by people?
Well, I think for Western audiences, and I mean, Sailor Moon, we have to remember, is a global phenomenon, like an absolutely global phenomenon. It's not just Japan and the United States. It's pretty much the entire world. But there's a huge hole that remains to this day in American comics for an accessible series of, you know, superheroes that are teenage girls, you know, that can actually be read by teenage girls at the same time, right? Because, I mean, you can go back and look at Marjorie Liu's X-23 series. Great series. Loved it. Would I hand it to anybody under the age of 17? No.
Right.
You know, it's X-23, right? That was it. And even her run was pretty bloody. And, you know, and Dokken got involved in that kind of stuff. But Sailor Moon, it's all ages, and it's accessible. And it's all about girls. And if you want to talk about the Bechdel test, I mean, you know, recently a blogging friend of mine had talked about how you can't even run that test on a single issue-by-issue basis for most comics because of the way the stories work. Well, the funny thing about Sailor Moon is that even if you wanted to knock it down to every single issue as opposed to an arc or a volume, it will, because it's all about these female characters. And there are, you know, especially for a series that came out in the early 90s anywhere, both in the animation and the comic book, a lot of really progressive stances on things, in kind of without necessarily framing it as such or saying it specifically, that does break down things like rape culture and that kind of stuff. And it's just, you know, it's a great series about female friendship that is queer inclusive. And that's kind of the most ironic thing about its translation to North America. I mean, are you guys aware of the history behind Sailor Uranus and Neptune?
I am, but I
don't want to assume that people don't know. So let's assume that.
I'm clueless, so feel free to educate.
Okay. Sailor Uranus and Neptune were, I don't know how they're originally introduced in the manga, because I'm not that far into it yet. I'm just reading it for the first time. I'm more comfortable with the animated series, but they are a lesbian couple, right? And it's not danced around. It's not something like what we're seeing in TV today, whether it's, you know, the pseudo-homoeroticism of Sherlock, right? Or, you know, I wouldn't even say Supernatural, really, but that kind of thing, right? Where it's will they or won't they, are they or aren't they, you know, like Marceline and Princess Bubblegum. It's very clear. They're in a committed relationship together. And it is a little bit of, you know, your typical butch-femme dynamic, in the sense that Uranus, when she's out of costume and her civilian identity, is very androgynous. And when Sailor Venus and Moon first meet her, they think that she's just an androgynous boy and are very attracted to her, and it's pretty funny how things work out from there. But when it came over to the States and it was cut down, they were introduced as being cousins. And they attempted to, you know, edit the dialogue and the animation as much as possible to not convey the sense that they were, you know, a couple. But their body language and interactions, even just on a basic visual level, were such that it was very uncomfortable, because these are supposedly cousins, but they were pretty obviously involved one way or another. So I guess kind of, you know, the way that that Mark Millar was trying to push the envelope with, you know, Wanda and Pietro in the Ultimates, only a really backfired attempt at censorship. So my understanding is there's a lot of people who were not necessarily in geek culture, in mainstream geek culture, in their teens or whatever, who watched the show as kids, who have no idea what the truth is, because the uncensored versions that came out in, you know, 2002, 2004, whatever it was, weren't as, you know, heavily touted or widely available. So I don't know how many people out there in the mainstream that watched Sailor Moon as a kid even know that, what the original intent of those characters were.
That's just super impressive, you know, for a series that was aimed at people of all ages at that time. Yeah. I mean, and culturally, like, I mean, obviously American pop cultural representations of queer people have its own weight and baggage, whereas ones from Japan have their own, you know, issues and history as well. But I just think that that's such a example of, like, how radically different two cultures could be in their handling of these subjects right now.
Well, I mean, yes and no, because my understanding is that it was fairly not anomalous at the time. And there isn't, like, it's tough for me to even say as a casual observer who isn't sitting there reading the Japanese newspapers every day, but I would say they're about, probably from what I understand, as in terms of societal acceptance somewhere near where we are. So I don't think it would be too much to expect one way or another, because, I mean, it's still, you know, properties that would involve queerness very specifically as the focus would still be considered just as much of a niche there as they are here, right? And, I mean, a lot of what we see in terms of queer content coming over from Japan when it's, you know, gay male type stuff, with, you know, everybody's favorite acronym, the YAOI, and so on. A lot of that is written by women and not necessarily for a gay male audience, right? So there's a lot of cultural nuance that kind of goes into trying to understand the stuff that comes over here from there, because it's not necessarily what a surface reading with Western eyes would think it is, right? That's kind of why I caution a little bit when we talk about approaching manga from, you know, Western social justice perspective. You kind of have to be careful, because there's a whole lot of embedded meanings and history behind what's coming from there that it may look like this to us, but it's not necessarily what they saw or what they intended when it was created, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Because those relationships are constructed differently in their culture.
Yeah.
I know nothing about manga. I've read maybe a handful of books, but one series, not necessarily about social justice, but very political, I highly recommend for folks. If you're ever interested, there's really cool concepts called First President of Japan, which I read a few years ago, and the concept was that Japan went to direct elections, and there's a meltdown in the Far East between China, North Korea, South Korea, U.S. relations, and the whole political dynamic between everything. I thought it was fantastic, and it was written by a guy who was like a professor at Johns Hopkins. So it really came from a great political perspective. Really, really recommend it. Very cool series.
Well, yeah. One series, actually, that I mentioned my name quickly that you would probably absolutely adore was Pluto. And I wish I could remember the author's name here, but it was a great series that was essentially a retelling of Astro Boy. But Astro Boy himself doesn't appear until late in the game. But I don't want to belittle it by saying this, but the truth of the matter is that it's essentially the manga equivalent of The Watchmen, which is kind of a loaded term. But in terms of the way that he takes this classic story and updates it into a contemporary political and social context, where basically it's the same general plot line as The Watchmen happens, because there's all the major world powers have an advanced, one or two advanced androids, basically, right? But they're considered to be weapons of mass destruction. There was a lot of issues involving these robots' involvement in a very controversial war, right? And so one by one, these robots, these most powerful robots that are in part important to, you know, maintaining the kind of balance of powers globally, are being murdered, right? Just like each one of the members of the Minutemen were being knocked off, right? In like the comedian's murder at the beginning of The Watchmen.
I would say,
you know, kind of tonally, and what the message you get at the end of Pluto is far, far different than The Watchmen. There's no, it happened 30 minutes ago or whatever it was. There's no space squid or whatever, but definitely, if there's anybody listening who's a fan of Alan Moore, and I'm guessing there might be one or two, look up Pluto and give it a shot.
Pluto.
You'll probably really like it, yeah.
Awesome.
I just Googled it to look it up, so. Okay, it goes on my read list.
Yeah, seriously, thank you. I definitely want to make sure we give ourselves enough time to talk about FF, the show, because I know that's one of the topics that we really want to make sure we hit on, and a comic that I'm a huge fan of, huge, mm-hmm. And really, really love this issue as well. You might be working on a column about this comic, but...
Well, I've pitched a column to a non-comic website that I'm waiting to hear back about. There was a call called for submissions. So it's an unpaid gig, so I don't know how many people they're looking to take on. It might just be anyone who looks good. So I'm, in theory, the idea would be introducing comics to people who are not big into them, which I think would be very exciting. Because I love talking comics with people who already love them. But there's segments of audiences out there who aren't reading comics who could be very who could find a lot in them that have been kind of traditionally marginalized by the marketing or the culture, and that's who I'd be writing for, in theory. But I think the most important thing that has to be said about FF is that it's the funniest comic book since Next Wave.
That's high praise.
Do we agree with that? Disagree?
I'm thinking about that. That might be true. Yeah. When did Next Wave come out? Roughly, was that?
2007, 2008.
Then,
it's about like 6 years ago.
Yeah.
I am inclined to agree with you. My non-scientific, not thought about it extensively answer is that yes, this is probably the funniest comic since then.
Mm-hmm.
I seriously cannot stop referencing the "a date is a fruit, a fruit." Well, I mean, I have a specific voice in my head for what the the Moloid children sound like, and that is what they sound like to me. No matter what anyone else thinks, and I can't not think about that. The images of the Moloid children eating makeup, like, speak to me on a deeper personal level. I hope that these various substances are not toxic to their Moloid systems, because I know there are a lot of products, a lot of the chemicals and personal care products aren't really something you want to ingest, but I do believe that the Moloid children eating She-Hulk's makeup is the cutest, most adorable thing I've seen in a long time in a comic book. And we were all just really excited to see the past couple of issues where, you know, they've had, oh my God, I'm so terrible. Which is the kid who just came out as being female? Turd?
Yeah. No,
huh?
It's, you got it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Turd. Okay, great. And her, you know, telling everyone that she identifies as female. No, sorry, Tong. Turg is the one that's the floating
head. Tong, yeah.
Tong,
yeah.
Yes. Tong telling that she identifies as female, and everyone really embracing her. It was, like, just wonderful. So that's my short version, but I think folks have already heard me talk about this book a lot. I should probably shut up and let our guests talk about it some, too. it's funny. What else do folks need to know?
I also say it's, like, a really positive series.
It is. It
like
is.
It's one of those few comics that you're not down after reading it. You feel good. It gets you to laugh. Like, everything about it is positive, which is such a rare, and it's so sad to say how rare that is.
Without being, what's the word? I don't want to necessarily say empty-headed, but you know, frivolous, without being frivolous, right? Which is something that I think the Adventure Time comics really thrive on, too. And that series as a whole is that the lesson here is that you can be lighthearted and upbeat and still be significant. And when I first really seriously got into comics as an adult, past the whole like raging hormone stage of being 14 and reading comics, which I don't want to get into, nobody does. right. I was 14 in 1998. Okay. So you can imagine, you know, all of the horrible purchasing decisions that happened based on what was in the market back then. You're laughing because you know. But, you know, when I got serious into Vertigo, into that kind of stuff, reading Grant Morrison stuff, and even though a lot of his stuff was pretty dark, you know, even in that dark stuff, he came hammering back to the point, you know, stop being so dark. Stop with all the rape and the murder. We don't need it. You know, if you go back and read, Animal Man and Flex Mentallo, which, who loves God, is actually back in print, which is amazing, right? You know, you read these things, and the villain of Flex Mentallo was this, I call him Brad Meltzer, but that's another story. But it is basically this repressed, this adult who's like a repressed teenager, and he never grew past adolescence in that sense, and he still has this very adolescent sense of adulthood and darkness and gloom. And it's so great to really kind of see the message from that come out in such a great comic. But, I mean, one of the great things about FF is that if you hire Mike Allred for a series, then it's going to have to be, right? You know, he's going to, he forces, tonally he forces it, you know, well, and Laura, of course, as well. I can't, you know, talk her down at all. But, and then Paul Mounts of Colors is a huge thing because even like the issue we're talking about, of course, was not actually, Mike was not there for that one. It's Joe Quinones that drew that one, right?
Yeah.
Where we're talking initially comes out. But, and that's another one of the greatest things about this title, right? Because they keep it so on point that it took me two pages to realize that it wasn't Mike Allred. I was like, man, Mike's having kind of a weird day. This doesn't look like his usual stuff. And then I was like, wait a minute, that's not Mike Allred at all. But the inking and the coloring kept the tone and the pacing perfect. It kept it right where it needed to be. And one, well, my Twitter icon is from that issue too, actually. So made a big impact. But, you know, but Fraction's also keeping it light as well. I mean, he still has that kind of New York hipster, not hipster, but like, you know, I'm so cool for, you know, knowing New York as well as I do kind of vibe. While keeping it light, but there's just so many great things about it, in being able to do referential humor and keep it light, whether it's that giant monster that's been sitting in the East River for God knows how long, or the Yancey Street gang being essentially, you know, anonymous. They're these 4chan or Redditor guys, right?
Yeah.
With the thing masks instead of their Guy Fawkes masks, and they've got the Mass Effect costume hoodies. It was fantastic. You know, to keep it, you know, current and modern is a key thing, right? Especially in little stuff like that. I mean, who knows? I don't know what the direction on the script was for those hoodies, who came up with it, but whether it was Joe, whether it was Matt, it was a great choice. But the other key piece of what's so exciting about that issue and the Tong thing is that, number one, actually genuinely trans characters are so few and far between in comics and superhero comics. And the second thing is children, right?
Yes.
In any type of fiction. And that's why it's so huge, and it's so huge, and that it's the future foundation, right? I think it was probably last week, maybe the week before, I tweeted something to the effect that, you know, who would have thought that the Fantastic Four would steal the crown of being the home of queer family in the Marvel Universe from the mutants. That's so bizarre. You know, because not to say there hasn't been greater progressive storytelling from the Fantastic Four before, but they were always kind of the nuclear normative family, not in an exclusionary sense like we see with the Wizard, with Bentley's dad there.
Yeah.
When he just comes right out and says it. But, you know, they were kind of a traditional 20th century family, whereas, like, in FF at least, you know, the team they've assembled there is this wild Technicolor 21st century family in all senses, right? They're breaking so many boundaries, and it's so great to see that, because one of the things is that the X-Men since Claremont have kind of pushed queer representation forward and backwards at the same time. Right, because it's been such a habit of a lot of writers and editors to hide behind the metaphor, right? Do you really need, I don't think anyone's actually come out and said, we don't actually need to have gay superheroes because we already have a metaphor for them with the X-Men. But I think that's a mentality that goes into creating a lot of characters when it comes to writers, artists, or editors who don't fall under that umbrella. Well, we've got the X-Men for that, right? When in point of fact, I'm sure there's a few queer X-Men, for sure. There are a few. Not really many heavy hitters that you see on a month-by-month basis, but they're there, right? And we buy them whenever we see them. But it's a whole other issue between the metaphor and the actuality. And with trans characters, it's so much more important, because how many lists have you seen going back to, like, the GeoCities days of the Internet, where they'll have, like, an LBGT whatever list of characters in comics, and you're going down the T category, and they've got like Mystique in there, And it's like, are you kidding me? What planet are you from? Right? So there's a little bit of a metaphorical thing. So, I mean, if you're a trans person, you could obviously very easily imprint on Mystique, especially at a young age, like I did. Or other shapeshifters, right? I mean, who knows? Maybe there's somebody out there who identifies deeply with Super Skrull for that reason. But you can't really attach it that way because it doesn't actually sit right with the actual lived experience of what that is, right? I mean, sure, if you could just shapeshift like that, boom, life is easy. It takes away none of the issues. So as a bit of a fantasy, as a power fantasy, which, as we all know, superheroes, that's the key idea of what they are. It's fantastic to have a power fantasy like that, whether it's that or the abominably mishandled, you know, Zavin character in Runaways, or even, what is his name? Hulkling, right, where there's these different shapeshifters. But, I mean, one of the key things, of course, is that the shapeshifters, they all have, pretty much all shapeshifters in mainstream superhero fiction have a very defined, centered gender identity. They are what they are, and if they're gonna, you know, switch over to another gender presentation, it's for a specific reason, like a diversion or, you know, subterfuge or something, right? It's not the same way that we treat gender presentation in our normal lives for those of us who aren't shapeshifters. So it doesn't really track that way, and there's still such a push and pull in superhero fiction over, well, are we just delivering power fantasies, or are we trying to create the future in superhero fiction? And that's kind of, to me, one of the biggest existential struggles in superhero fiction today, is where do we go from here? I think the 90s should have at least shown us that pushed the whole power fantasy thing to the, you know, to the limit, right? With you know, Cable and these types of characters, and it's just like, well, you know, we've pushed this as far as it can go, and that's not the answer to the future of superhero comics. So where do they go from here? And, you know, we've kind of seen a little bit how the Claremont version of the X-Men, because he was kind of one of the real guys who first started that, sort of moving it more towards a metaphor for queerness as opposed to racial discrimination or something like that, right? The biggest, loudest metaphors, like the legacy virus. It was the AIDS virus, right?
Yeah, very literally and clearly.
Yeah.
Yeah, like my little brother was a kid when those came out, and he got that, and he was like elementary school, you know, kid.
Mm-hmm. I
was going to say with the X-Men, it always seemed that they kind of fit the series and the allegory to what was going on at the time. Like, when it first started, it was clearly civil rights, and then eventually it turned to gay rights and the AIDS epidemic, and it just kind of evolved, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but at the same time...
No, it's a good thing.
I think, yeah, it's a good thing in that you can discuss these things, but at the same time, I think they also almost struggle nowadays with, like, what do they represent and where are they going, whereas FF, I think it was, at least with this one character... It's much clearer, and there is a message of inclusion that Matt is putting out there. And it's just interesting, I think, comparing the two, where you've got one that was the, you know, standard bearer of advocacy and talking about groups, and then this is almost usurper that's coming out of here that's just like, you know, I'm just going to straight up throw it out there. And I think you're seeing that with a lot of the comics nowadays, too, is they're almost, like, hitting you overhead in a good way of being like, no allegory, we're just throwing it out there. You know, like, a couple weeks ago, we had Matt Miner, who wrote Liberator, which is a comic about animal rights and superhero-dom.
Yeah.
You've got Occupy Comics that have come out. Like, it's just more in your face. We are, you know, here's our message, and we're making it clear.
Right. Yeah.
I'm sorry, can you say it again, Emma?
Oh, just saying the movement, right? That's what that is.
Yeah.
Or even, you know, Bendis's Scarlet. But, I mean, and I don't know that the rudderlessness of the X-Men is a bad thing, but I do like that they've moved to a model of queerness, because there is a big problem when you get into, like, if with civil rights in the X-Men, they're still mostly white. So it's kind of, it was a really kind of a junky thing to, you know, to be like, well, what if white people were discriminated against the same way? Well, that's just goofy. They should have actually been talking about more black superheroes dealing with that kind of stuff directly. But I do think that the Carinus is a better functional metaphor for the X-Men because it can cut across. It is something, a piece of a person, that can cut across so many other you know, groups, whether it's class or race or religion or whatever. It is kind of a universal thing like that because there is such a diversity within the rainbow, hence it being a rainbow. But that kind of struggle for what does it mean is actually right at the forefront of the X-Men books right now, right? Between what Remender is saying on Uncanny Avengers and what Bendis is saying in All New X-Men. but with the, I don't know if you saw the Kitty Pryde speech.
Yep.
Which reads as a direct rebuttal to Alex's speech, right? And it would just read like that if Twitter didn't exist, and if we didn't know what Remender himself had said, right? Because I don't think anybody expected Remender to actually be on Alex's side. I didn't.
Right.
And
exactly.
You don't have to be on the side of the characters you're writing, whether they're heroes or not. I mean, he certainly wasn't a huge fan of X-Force when he wrote them, right? He's like, these people are doing terrible things. But there's value in exploring oppositional viewpoints.
Yeah, it really threw me off that he got defensive about that. I had assumed that that was just Alex Summers saying something that Alex Summers would totally say.
Which makes him say Mr. Handsome.
And then how he responded to it. I almost feel like he was just digging in his heels.
Yeah.
You know, like, emotional.
I wonder, like, how much pile on that. Man, you're a writer, and all these people are coming out being like, what the hell did you just write? And, you know, the entire internet just implodes on you. Dan Slott has dealt with the same stuff with Spider-Man. You know, it's kind of suck nowadays to be a creator and have Twitter and Facebook.
I think you got to, as a reader, the impulse is there to go in on them. But you know what?
Mm-hmm.
Keep it in the gutters. Don't keep it out of the, keep it in the gutters. Keep it on panel. I think there's way more fun to be had right now if you're reading those issues, right? If you're reading what Alex is saying and what Kitty is saying and not reading don't read it as Remender saying this and Bendis saying that. Like, we have the luxury of being so metafictional with the internet and social media that the concept of the author is dead is flying right out the window, and we're attributing way too much to authorial intent and stuff. And sometimes it's good to talk about. When we talk about issues like representation and FF, that's great. That's awesome because, you know, where's Matt Fraction coming from writing this? Well, Fraction is a writer who, in my opinion, having read his work since Casanova, the more of himself that he puts into his comics and the more that he illuminates later on and where they came from his life, the more interesting he gets and the better the reading experience is. Because, you know, FF is entirely written from the perspective of a father, which is, to me, one of the main two viewpoints any creator should approach that property from, whether mother, father, or, maybe a non-binary, a parent, let's say, right?
Mm-hmm.
From the perspective of the parents. So, and we're seeing that in everything, from Bentley and from Scott, right? Essentially from Medusa, all of it is about family. So we're seeing so much more about a little bit. We are seeing a bit of his perspective on family and being a father in these characters. It's really hard to look at Bentley and not think that maybe he's Henry, Fraction's son, or Valerie being his daughter. It is kind of tough, to be like, all right, these are fictional characters. Not everything they do is based on things his kids do. But some of these personal details that go into his writing, his approach, are, you know, did you guys read Siege?
Not like as its own book. Like when it, you
the
mean
event,
like,
yeah.
like Siege of Asgard or like?
Yeah, yeah. When they, when what's his face, Norman Osborn and Hammer attacked Broxton.
Yep, I read it. I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a Marvel event.
You read Marvel. I just read the books I was going to read anyway that happened
afterwards.
To happen during those events.
I do that too. But, you know, and there's a huge controversial moment where Tony sacrifices his sobriety to Odin to finally get him to get involved, right? Because Odin was playing the wait-and-see approach. He didn't want to get involved, right? No, no, sorry. No, Fear Itself. I'm getting these mixed up.
Oh,
it was Fear Itself.
Yeah.
Wait and Siege.
Okay.
Sorry. Oh, because both of them involve Thor books. No, no, sorry. Fear Itself. In Fear Itself, because Odin did not want to get involved, and that was the key turning point when Tony sacrificed his sobriety, you know. And a lot of people, you know, were angry about this, that, you know, why are we using Tony's sobriety as a football? But I didn't read it that way, personally. But, you know, and it came out, and Fraction wrote more about that, and the very personal perspective of that, that piece of storytelling came from. And it's so great to be able to see, you know, people being able to put those struggles down on paper and get them out there. You know, and sure, I mean, there was a bit of a backlash about it, but it created a dialogue. And it got people talking again about, well, what is the place of sobriety in Iron Man's, you know, story? Is it something that we should revisit? Excuse me, is it something that we should bury? In my opinion, no, I don't think we should bury it, because, you know, people who struggle with sobriety, all of them do it on a daily basis, you know.
Yep.
So that's
I'm actually disappointed
that
they kind of dumped it.
Yeah. Well, I would imagine a lot of that probably had to do with the marketability of Iron Man as a Hollywood character, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Which is kind of ironic, given, you know, Robert Downey Jr. And, you know, and his history with addiction, right? Because, I mean, that was one of the reasons why I was like, wow, Robert Downey Jr.'s Iron Man, that's great. He has the perfect background for this. He has a lived experience, you know, to portray this correctly. So whether or not they get into it in future films, I don't know. But that's kind of the thing, is that it's so neat to get to see creators who are putting their lived experience into this new brand of superhero comics, you know, and the group of writers who are going to say, let's make superhero comics about tomorrow and not about yesterday.
And I kind of like that with Bendis and his you know, launch of Miles Morales. And when you talk to him, when he was talking about it, you know, his comic, he comes from a mixed family, and you know, has I think an adopted son, and he was like, I want to create a comic for my kids. And, you know, these are kids of different backgrounds. And, you know, let's face it, comics are very white, and he wanted to do something different. I applaud on that. I mean, like, his also with the all-new X-Men, I think, is a very interesting take on idealism and, you know, that great feeling when we're young, of, you know, how we're going to change the world, you know, especially from us who, you know, our political background. And kind of that, you know, fading of the idealism. And then when you mix that with Scarlet, those two are a very interesting combination to read together. And I really wonder how much of that's coming from Bendis himself. I've tried to, you know, hopefully at some point get an interview with him, and that's, like, the question I want to ask is, like, where's that coming from? Because it's an interesting combination from one person.
Well, no, it certainly is, and that's what's, that's what's so fun. That's kind of the good side and the bad side of having access to who these people are that write them, and that double-edged sort of social media. It's funny that the trade copy that I have of Kevin Smith's first volume of Daredevil was written by Ben Affleck. So I was kind of a Johnny come lately to that run on Daredevil at the time. But he was talking about growing up as a kid and not really thinking about the fact that people even write these, that there's a person there. They just kind of happen, right? You don't think about it. You don't realize that. And he didn't really even confront that notion until Kevin Smith was writing Daredevil, and they're already established friends, having done Chasing Amy and all that prior to Smith's run. So it's kind of funny where now the default, at least among the adult readers and us of a similar generation, you know, we're engaging, we're looking for the face behind the page so much now. You know, what are their motivations behind this?
Yeah.
Very
which I think connects
true.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Which I think connects really interestingly with you know, the fact that folks are really talking now about the lack of diversity amongst creators. You know, I feel like this is all happening at the same time, and it's not a coincidence. We have more accessibility to the creators. We're also asking more questions about who are these people, you know, and how do they get to be the voices, and who gets to tell stories. It's all happening at the same time. Yeah.
Well, it's a need and a desire for transparency that's pervading almost every piece of life right now. I mean, obviously, you know, when we look at all these whistleblowers and leakers around now, I mean, obviously the Edward Snowden thing is getting a lot more complicated now that we know his actual political beliefs prior to this whole situation, but there seems to be this deep desire for transparency in this generation that will go so far as to potentially ruin someone's entire life, you know, and put them on the run forever, put them in jail for life for sharing this information. But I think that's kind of maybe it's a generational thing, because isn't it largely a lot of the same people who want that transparency about and access to, say, fiction and who's creating fiction and, you know, who's being cast in the movies and, you know, who's writing the stories, aren't they also the people who are the most passionate about knowing what Prism is and things like that?
Hmm.
I think it's a return to that, and a return to, you know, a need and a desire for transparency that maybe hasn't been seen since the 70s. But not to bring it down too much, but we do have to talk about Pizza Dog.
Pizza Dog.
How many reviews have you guys read of that issue?
A few. Not tons. I try not to read other people's reviews because I don't want them to influence what I think.
To taint.
Like, and my read itself, yeah. Like, really taint it.
How many people have mentioned Will Eisner and the Spirit that you've seen so far?
I don't think any that I've read.
That's weird to me. That is so weird. Because that, like, through that whole series, like, that's the one thing that keeps coming back to me. And I haven't read a ton of the Spirit. I've read kind of mostly the collected stuff, the best ofs and what have you they put out every once in a while. But you know, even the whole idea of him living in that Brooklyn building and hanging out on the roof with the other people there is something that Eisner, you know, in his stories played with, in that style of congregating on the rooftops in New York in a very different decade, of course. But that was a huge visual piece of the summertime stories in the Spirit. And even just like the perspective of it being, you know, all about Lucky and how Lucky sees the world for that issue reminded me so much of the toy gun story from The Spirit.
Is that, I'm going to have to go back and reread that.
There's a whole issue.
I need to go read The Spirit, yeah.
You do. Everybody needs to read The Spirit. Because Will Eisner was one of the huge innovators. He was doing, I mean, Jack Kirby, you know, we think of him and his amazing visuals and the Kirby dots and the way that he broke open storytelling in that sense, and with these huge, you know, the vastness of space and the fourth world and stuff. But Will Eisner was one of those big guys who was working at the other end, making stories smaller, you know, that really spoke to the human condition, you know, and the average or the marginalized. And obviously there was, there was some, you know, not so great stuff in there. Like, what was the little cab driver, the kid that always drove him around?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The, you know, the portrayal of that kid, not so hot, not great.
No.
But he really broke open storytelling in some great ways through those stories, too. And that whole story from the perspective of a toy gun is, like, you have to go back at that and be like, wow, you know. And that's the thing to me is that I don't want to take away from Hawkeye 11. It was a great issue. And I think it really harkens back to that toy gun story and other experiments in that really, you know, where urban storytelling can still be wildly experimental and visionary. And we need reminders, you know, that superhero stories, you know, they can be progressive like we see in FF, you know, that they can inform the future, which is exactly what the Future Foundation is, right?
Yeah.
But then also that formatting and the way that we tell stories can always be wider or different, and there's an appetite for it, right? And we need those callbacks every once in a while to tell us, well, even the way we look at this fiction can be so much bigger. And it's probably going to be the most talked about issue of the year, right? I'd be surprised if it doesn't get an Eisner next year.
I'm sure that issue is going to get nominated for Eisner next year, and definitely will be making best of lists. I mean, I would be shocked if that's not the case, because to me, out of everything I've read this year, that's one of the few issues that even stands out. I sat there and was like, wow, this feels like a really new take, but at the same time, I could, you know, I got that retro sense. It was just a fun read and different perspective, and and that's kind of what Fraction does. I mean, Fraction's a hell of a writer, and
yeah,
is able to do that stuff. I mean, the same week or 2 weeks ago, you know, Satellite Sam came out, which was, you know, unlike anything else that he's writing right now.
It is, but I don't think it's...
No, I
I'll
mean, it's not his strongest work, but yeah, exactly. Like, it's him doing noir, which I think was a really interesting thing that I haven't seen him do in a while. So, you know, that combined with Chaykin's art, I think is just really, really interesting. But, you know, that's totally different than Hawkeye and that look, and absolutely different than his work on FF with Alred. Like, it's, you know, he's one of the few writers that I think really changes from issue to issue. I mean, like, you know a Bendis comic, you know a Brubaker comic, you know a Hickman book. Like, Fraction really is one of those few that, at the same time, like, to me, it varies a lot.
It can, but but if you get really nitpicky, there are a few things you can pick out about him right away. Like, the first issue of FF is exactly like how the first arc of the Order played out, right? In that, in the Order, there was these interviews, these entry interviews with every member of the 50 States Initiative California team. And they'd be talking, like, straight to the camera and this kind of stuff. And they do the same thing with FF, where Reed is introducing Scott to everybody, right? You know, who are you? What do you do? And it took me a couple issues to remember. I was like, wait a minute, I've seen him do this somewhere. There are a few things. He does have a tone, and the way that he treats referential humor, like when they're standing around after old man Johnny gets soaked there by the water monster, and Scott makes a reference to I don't even know what, something being in the bottom of the East River, and you know, this thing is like, who is that? And She-Hulk says, it doesn't matter, he's old, right? But it's the same dynamic between the Hawkeyes, really. You know, whenever Clint talks about something old, and Kate just kind of gives him the brush off, or how he tries to counter her modern references. Yeah. Like the whole thing with when he was pretending not to know who Jay-Z is, right? And she says, and he says that the most important musician out of New York was some guy who played with Kiss, who I didn't know the guy's name before. The only person named Bruce who's important in music out of New York is, was that guy from Kiss, and not Bruce Springsteen from New Jersey.
I've recently come to, I have many things I can say about KISS, but I will not do them right now. But we should totally talk about KISS at some point in time. So much interesting and also awful going on there. I actually never read any comics. I've never read any KISS comics. I don't like giving KISS my money, but I can't help but giving them my ears on occasion. And certainly giving them my vocals when I do karaoke. Regardless.
By Wu-Tang Comics.
Oh, yeah?
If you don't already. Yeah.
They do exist.
Are they
you got the 12...
I don't think there's anything
just
current, but every once in a while. Did they recently?
Hmm. Yeah, Black Mask did. It's the 12 Ways of the Samurai, I think it is. Let me Google it.
Or are you talking about the mini comic that came out with Ghostface's last album? The 12 Ways to Die thing?
Yeah, 12 Ways to Die. But that's a couple issue series, I think.
Oh, okay, I only ever heard about a mini comic that came with the deluxe version of the album. I'll have to look that up.
No, so yeah, there was an actual full comic. I don't know the CD, so I have no idea like what came with that. But I got a regular, you know, series that came out or like a month ago. I think the second issue drops this week. Was
there
cool. Like, it was an interesting thing. Very, very Wu-Tang. I mean, like, you know, mobsters and kung fu and it's exactly what the hell I just got from them.
Well, the album, the concept of the album was about like a fictional, a 1960s Italian horror movie about a mafia hitman who had been melted down into wax, into like a wax record. So like if you played the record, it would summon him.
Whoa.
So now the comic makes way more sense now that you said that.
Okay. Is that basically the basis of the comic?
Yeah, it's the comic. It's basically... Oh, okay. A guy is collecting these records, and you don't really know why, but bad things seem to happen with the records.
Oh, so that's at least a huge spoiler?
I have no idea. I'm assuming that's where it's going to go, but I don't know. It's cool. Like, now that I know that, I can actually understand it more. So I read through the first issue. I was like, all right, this is cool. I have no idea what's going on, but this is kind of cool.
Well, Wu-Tang is relevant because Matt Fraction did drop one reference to them in Casanova way back. So I'm going to defend my Wu-Tang moment with that.
Huh. I really like. I only read two of the Casanova books, actually. I mean to get. Is there anything after that? I should pick it up. I thought they were really quite fantabulous and fun. And I guess what I'm looking for would be. Exuberant, yeah.
The energy, yeah.
Yeah, and very Mick Jagger, of course. And slightly incestuous, but, yeah.
Well, it's a lot of the basis for it is based on Michael Moorcock's Jerry Cornelius
novels. That makes a lot of sense. I actually started reading a lot of Elric stuff, I guess, last year, and... I haven't read any Jerry Cornelius stuff specifically, but if you're going to read any Elric stuff, they'll always talk about Jerry Cornelius stuff in whatever prologue of the book you pick up. So I can definitely see that,
I only read the Cornelius or the Jerry Cornelius stuff because my friend who got me into Casanova said this is what it's based on. So I have no geek superiority there. I totally read Moorcock only because of Fraction. And it was a great decision, don't get me wrong, but he's the only reason I did it.
Oh, that's interesting. I actually just, when I was getting my hair done a couple weeks back at my hair place, they actually had some old Elric comics that had been put out by 2000 AD in the 80s. They were beautiful. I should post the link to them after the show, if folks could check out. The art was just crazy good, and I don't know, just a fantastic 80s British psychedelic comic art feel that I love. You know, like something out of heavy metal, but like in a good way. Something out of heavy metal magazine, but like at its best, you know. I mean, for me, it's also sort of nostalgic, but it's like nostalgic for something I'm sure I wasn't allowed to read at the time, so I'm not entirely sure how it is that calls back these memories for me. But it was really neat. It was really neat. And I hadn't read any other Michael Moorcock-related comics other than that specifically like this is his stuff done in comic form. But for folks who aren't familiar, he was a really important, I mean, continues to be a really important, but really breakthrough sword and sorcery and science fiction author from the late 60s and started just went on from there, who just really changed the genre, created created a whole new anti-hero type, and really brought sex and drugs and rebellion into the genre in ways other people hadn't really done before, and also happened to tour with the band Hawkwind and write some of their songs. So. And
well,
he had avant-garde bands, too.
Well, even more than that, he really kind of created the idea of the multiverse, right?
Multiverse,
because when,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when Alan Moore brought that into comics for the first time in Captain Britain, it was largely influenced by Moorcock. And, I mean, Grant Morrison, Neil Gaiman, obviously Matt Fraction, you know. But guys, going back to that, most of that, you know, the, what do you call it, the British invasion, you know, that Karen Berger started with what became Vertigo, a lot of those guys were hugely informed by Moorcock at the time. So he's kind of, he sort of is one of the, you know, founding fathers of modern comics in a strange way.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, anyone that talks about the multiverse has to throw props to him and his creation. I, you know, really don't see without him it being what it is today.
No.
We usually do for about an hour. I don't mind going later, but I do want to see. I want to make sure we want to wrap up before. Before we close out for today, are there any other comics that you want to tell us that folks need to be reading, or anything else we want to make sure we hit before this week news-wise? I'm terrible because I never cover the superhero movies. Like, I just don't cover them. they're usually terrible, so I haven't.
Iron Man is the only superhero franchise you need to worry about as far as movies go.
Is that out yet?
That's my opinion.
Three out.
Iron Man 3?
No.
Yeah.
It's been out.
3's been out. It's and you know, talking about a social justice perspective, if people still haven't seen Iron Man 3 and they're concerned about the Mandarin, without saying anything else, if you don't know what happens, it's really well worth the watch. He's not what you might think he is. The fun thing about the Iron Man franchise, and you really kind of have to put your glasses on and really pay attention to what's going on in these movies beyond the surface of a soul. So second, third watch, whatever. But all the entire trilogy is all about the ultimate villains in all of these films are always rich white capitalists. You know, that's not the vehicle that the conflict comes through, right? Because, I mean, in the first one, you have these guys who are these, you know, international mercenaries that kidnap Tony. But, of course, as we find out, it's Obadiah Stane who's doing it to, you know, continue to fund this military-industrial complex cycle of violence to push the profits and to fund both sides. In Iron Man 2, Iron Man 2 is really, you know, just a replaying of Russian history in the early 1990s, you know, from an American perspective. You know, breaking out criminals and telling them, hey, you're in charge of my security now, and then terrible things happen, and they act like they're surprised, you know. I think it was probably a little more obvious in the second movie in that sense, right? Because, again, you have this evil capitalist in Justin Hammer who shows up, and he's trying to catch up to Tony, so he does something really stupid, but he's the ultimate, you know, cause of all this. And in the third movie, all I'm going to say is, again, like the first line of Iron Man 3 is, we create our own villains, right? I think, well, it's, I don't know if villains is the exact word, but something like that. We create our own enemies. Mm-hmm. And that's what Iron Man 3 is about again. So the whole Iron Man film franchise is about American imperialism backfiring constantly. That's what the entire film franchise is about. I mean, they stumble and trip over, you know, some issues of, what do you call it? presentation here and there, but that is what the wider sort of theme in all those movies is, in my opinion.
That's definitely accepted. Yeah. The better Iron Man writers, I feel like, have have hit on as well. Yeah, yeah.
Well, because they stole liberally from the best Iron Man stories. Well, not stole, because it was theirs to take. But, you know, I mean, Extremis was a big part of Iron Man 3. Well, the first movie, too, his entire origin was essentially the Extremis. Warren Ellis's, you know, redo of the origin, right? But that's one of the great things about it, is they went in and they dug up the best parts and used that, right?
Yeah, it's an opportunity for them to sort of rewrite the history for the better, or like rewrite the history for the modern eye almost in this time.
Yeah, because that's a great thing about Iron Man, because you can update him every time the U.S. invades somebody else, right? Because, I mean, the original Jack Kirby story, Stan Lee story, was Korea, I think, actually. It was the Korean War.
Yep.
And then they updated it later to Vietnam. And I think someone else updated it to the first Gulf War. Maybe that was an Elseworlds story, like an alternate universe story that wasn't actually in continuity, who knows. But then, of course, in Extremis, it's ambiguously Afghanistan. So, I mean, that's the kind of thing, is that, you know, he's always relevant in a way that, say, Captain America isn't necessarily. Like, you can't update Captain America.
No, but he works more like as a commentary on, like, this is actually what patriotism can mean. Like, it's not about jingoism, and this is what an actual American stereotypical construction of, like, responsibility to one's country and society would look like, you know, through these lenses.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I do think it's fantastic when they have him, like, do stuff like call people out on being fascist when they're being fascist. But, like, that's one of the great things about that character, is that he always has that perspective.
I kind of get that, but it still, to me, always feels incredibly uncomfortable with the fact that the embodiment of, like, the major embodiment of American patriotism is this blonde-haired, blue-eyed guy who punched Hitler. You know, it's kind of like, but that's why I love stories like the one about, God, why do I always get his name wrong? The sort of the quote-unquote first Captain America. Patriot's grandfather. A Patriot's grandfather. Like him, and even the existence of Patriot and, you know, Miss America Chavez, like those characters. I will say, though, that I do like that the quote-unquote America family, you know, has grown to include those characters as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm still kind of, I'm not a big Steve Rogers fan.
Gotcha. I wish people, I feel like I love Young Avengers, and I feel like the comic has gotten better at not referring to her as, like, with a modifier to say, like, which Miss America she is. It's like, no, she's Miss fucking America, thank you. And I feel like the comic has gotten better and stronger about that, which makes me happy. I like this. We should truly have talked about Young Avengers this issue, because this is all about the nature of millennial work. It's okay. Well, we'll have to do that in another issue. We definitely want to have you back on the show. Like, whenever you want to come back, just let us know, for real. This has been a lot of fun.
When I'm caught up on Young Avengers.
Yeah. Fantastic. Well, thank
you
so much for joining
us. Yeah, I'll say
a
hell of a lot. Yeah.
Yeah.
thank you, son.
Well, it was a
pleasure. Different conversation than we normally have.
Well, I got caught flat-footed on that manga thing. I was like, really? I don't know what to say about manga. So hopefully I BS my way well enough to that one.
Definitely.
You could have totally made that all up, and I would have been like, all right, sure. I know so little, so... Yeah.
It's true, at least, well, the objective parts of that, obviously there's some subjective and, you know, pieces of my own opinions in there, but the broad strokes, like, you looked it up, right? You know, Pluto exists.
No, that's on the to-buy list now.
But no, it was great, and I do look forward to, you know, to being on here again.
Fantastic.
Absolutely. We appreciate you having me on, and... it is absolutely an open invitation, so I'm sure we can go on for a few more hours if we wanted to.
Probably, but we have future episodes to worry about.
Yes, absolutely. Well, you know, we should we'll figure out when the next issue of Scarlet comes out. So I'm sure that could be a hell of a conversation.
Oh, well, I need to catch up on that, too. I'm several issues behind.
Yeah, I think it's been like 3 months since the last issue, so you're
oh, so
good.
It's okay. So it's still moving pretty slow.
Well, thank
God for Bendis writing half of Marvel's line. Then, you know, I'm never gonna complain about that again. Please, Bendis,
super,
keep writing like six.
Seriously,
he's a
Stephen King of comics. Like, I don't know how it's possible to create that much quantity of high quality work. Like, it doesn't seem possible.
I like Bendis a lot more than Stephen King.
Gotcha. Yeah, yes. I'm actually not particularly literate in the way of King, although my fiance swears by him. But it's still one of those. You know, he's known for someone who just put out a ton of stuff that's considered high quality.
Yeah.
When I see how much Bendis does, it's just like, how is that even freaking possible?
Well, even Fraction. Yeah, Fraction is pretty nut bar. I mean, have you seen all the stuff he has coming out from Image? Because it's not just that Satellite Sam we talked about. The most exciting upcoming piece is that.
Or whatever.
I wouldn't call that the most exciting.
we'll
see how that goes. Yeah, I'm going to be on the fence. I mean, I trust him enough with how he's going to play, but we'll see. Is the Odyssey one? That is, it looks to be what the kids would call Rule 63, retelling the Odyssey as, I think, a science fiction story.
Yeah.
The cover art solicited so far looks to be science fiction. But that to me, I'm excited for that. It's one of, like, only three of the new Image titles that seems to have strong female-driven storytelling attached to it.
Yeah, we're going to have to discuss Lazarus, too, at some point, speaking of Image and female leads.
Oh, yeah.
If you haven't read that one. I'm kind of on the fence
about
that one. So, yeah, it's a Rucka, who normally is great on that stuff. So on that first, I think it's Rucka, is the first one I kind of like went back and forth. So that is definitely a topic for the next one.
Mm-hmm.
I'm marking these down.
Good. We're running with.
Yes.
Well, if you guys
run a
special episode on Adventure Time, I'm right there for that one.
We'll do another one. I don't think Alana will have issues with that.
Not in the slightest. I want all of the different issues with a regularity, yeah.
Cool.
Well, thanks everyone for joining us this week. And
So if people want to follow you, how can they follow you online?
Oh, yeah. That's right.
I only poke my head up every now and then. I'll forward you guys the announcement if my column proposal gets picked up. But right now, pretty much just on Twitter, which is just the @ and @HOUXBOIS. That's all it is. I do have a Tumblr, but that's mostly just for, it's like Warren Ellis would say, don't follow it because it's just disconnected, rambling. I don't use Tumblr the way it's supposed to be. Like, I don't follow people or anything. That just gets too stressful. So I just kind of dump random words and letters there. But typically find me through Twitter is the easiest thing. If there's something worth reading coming out of my Tumblr or my Instagram, then I'll link it from my Twitter.
Gotcha.
Cool. Well, again, appreciate you coming on. Until next time.
Absolutely. Same bad time. Same bad channel.
Excellent. So, thanks. And I guess we will wrap up the show. So we're a bit over time. Wraps up another episode of Graphic Policy Radio, and thank you to our guest, Emma Hubois. And so we're at San Diego Con. I will definitely be there, and it's one of the biggest celebrations of fandom there is. So no matter if you're a fan, if you're a Twihard, Lord of the Rings fan, comic fan, music fan, television fan, whatever, go out there, praise your fandom, share your excitement with others, get them excited. And grow the base. So until next time, I'm Brett.
And I'm Ilana.
So keep on reading and have a geeky week.